girls. What? Keep it fresh.
Welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. In 2016, Enoch Pratt Free Library President Carla Hayden was selected to head the Library of Congress. Heidi Daniel was selected to replace her, stepping in to manage the 22-branch system. Heidi began her career in children's and teen programming in Oklahoma City and Houston before moving into library administration. Before coming to Baltimore, she was the director of Ohio's Youngstown and Mahoning County system. Right now, she is overseeing an $115 million renovation of the Pratt's historic Central Branch. Heidi talked about the role of libraries in both communities and in her life. Here's our conversation. Do you remember the first book you fell in love with?
I do remember the first books I fell in love with, and they were really the shoes series. So ballet shoes, circus shoes, or children's books. And I remember being young and just thinking they were fascinating because the children's lives were so different from mine. And, you know, I wasn't going to dance on stage in the ballet anywhere. And it was just fascinating. And then I think that was quickly followed by, I read every Ramona Quimby book.
Yes, I loved those.
Yeah, those
yes.
were the best, right? Yes. And I remember just sitting there, and I wished that she was my best friend. And I really wanted to hang out with her. I was about her age, I guess, when I was reading those. So the Ramona Quimby books really grabbed me. And then, you know, I went right into, like, Harriet the Spy. And I think I went through this brief, weird period where I wanted to be Harriet the Spy. So I would, like, walk around my neighborhood, like, pretending to spy on people and, like, taking little notes in my little yes. notebook. So
it was so cool. She went in, like, didn't she go in the elevator shaft or the rafters somewhere to spy on people?
Yeah.
I remember
she was
thinking,
like,
that was so cool.
Yeah. And I mean, it was stuff that would definitely get you in trouble and maybe even arrested. Like, I remember she would, like, peer in her neighbor's windows. And I mean, you know, you can't really do that, but I'm pretty sure it's frowned upon. But I loved that whole idea of just the way she was interested in all these people's lives. And I think, you know, that was just really relatable as a kid. And I was an only child. So I think my best friends tended to be people who were in books and weren't real. But that was great. And I loved it. And then as I progressed throughout school, obviously the types of literature I was reading changed. And I think I remember, I guess I think it was around my senior year of high school, I read The Color Purple. And that was, again, a whole other game changer for me. It was just such a poignant book and full of, again, experiences so far away from my own experiences, but really relatable. I think every book you find a character and you're like, oh, I see myself in that person. And so it's always been amazing to me to have this experience where I'm looking at an experience and a person and a situation that's so different from me and maybe something I've never been in. But there's something about that person or a character that you can go, oh, but I totally get why she feels that way, because I would feel that way. Or that experience, you know, that moment she's having right there, or that thought she's having is something that I might have, or I've had about something different. So the way I read started changing, and I started really being interested in also reading diverse books because I was so fascinated with this ability to get into the experience of other people and learn about the world that they inhabited. So it's just taken me on a great journey. But the first books I think I fell in love with were definitely the shoe books, and then followed by Ramona Quimby and Harriet the Spy. Those just really stick out from my childhood.
That's interesting that you took to reading diverse books early, because I feel like now a lot of people make an effort to do so. They're like, you know, they look back at what they've read and it's all white men or something.
Right,
and they're
right.
Like, oh, wow, I should really read more books by women. And it's for the exact reasons that you're saying. So
right.
Did that always come naturally to you?
Well, I don't know if it came naturally to me. I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, so far above everyone that, oh, yeah, I've been reading diverse books before it was cool. But I do think, I don't remember why I picked up Alice Walker's The Color Purple, but it was the first book I remember reading that was, I think, by a woman of color. And then I read The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. And again, different experience, but so very much real people and real thoughts and feelings. So I think I was also a women's studies major in undergraduate, so I was inclined to read diversely and to read a lot of women writers and to read writers from different countries and of different ethnicities and different races than myself. And now it's definitely something that I try to consciously do. I think when I was younger, I wasn't really being conscientious about it. I think I was just reading what appealed to me. So books that appealed to me happened to have some diversity to them, which is great. But I wasn't sitting around thinking, well, I want to make sure I'm not reading just white men. Now it's something that I'm very much wanting to be conscientious about because of the position I hold and the city we live in and the world around us. And it's something I want to instill in my children. And so it's now starting over with, for example, my daughter, who's 7, and she's an avid reader, and we go to the bookstore. And I want to make sure that she's picking out books with, you know, protagonists and main characters that aren't the same color as her or from the same country as her, so that she's seeing people in lead roles from the beginning that are different than her, and that she views that as normal as opposed to, you know, something she's got to search for. And it's really, it can be a challenge because there's a lot of books, like, you're not always looking for an issue book, right? Like, you kind of want a book, like recently she was reading a series about called Jada. I can't remember what the series names. I should have looked it up before I mentioned it. But she's an elementary school student. She leads a science club and she's real popular and she happens to be African-American. But it's about a, you know, an 8-year-old girl doing 8-year-old girl things. And she just happens to be African-American. And I think that's where I'm trying to be with my daughter right now, is finding those types of books where she sees other people in lead roles as well. And it's great because I know that those books weren't out there when I was a child. You know, it was Ramona Quimby was really similar to my experience in many ways. So it's great that we have some more options. And I think the publishing industry is really aware of the need and desire. Obviously, we need diverse books as a big movement in publishing right now. It's also a great website if people are looking for diverse books to access to. So
it kind of speaks to the larger conversation about, like, in criticism or in publishing, how sometimes it seems like, you know, men write the quote-unquote universal story, and then if you are in a minority of any kind, it is sometimes pigeonholed as, like, a domestic book or, a book about civil rights when in fact, women and people of color and whoever it may be are just writing their stories, and it can just be a kid's picture book with an African-American protagonist. So,
right, exactly.
So you have seen a lot of evolution in that in your life?
Yeah, I mean,
I think
we have a long way to go, but I think it's definitely something that people are aware of, and there is a movement out there to change it, and I think that it is, you know, moving in that direction. I think we as, you know, readers and as consumers need to be conscientious about making those choices and finding those titles and supporting those writers and buying them from your bookstore, checking them out from your library, so that more and more of those titles are there and are available. I do think we have a long way to go. You know, I can think of some books that I bought for my daughter that were great and that were spot on with that, but I still think there's not enough of them. It's still much easier for me just to get a book with a main character who is, you know, white, middle class child, you know, character. So I think we have a long way to go, but I do think it's improved since I was a child, for sure. And I am very hopeful that it's going to keep improving. And I think we just need to keep, you know, requesting it and being thoughtful about it.
What role did libraries play in your childhood?
So libraries played a huge role in my childhood. My parents adopted me when I was an infant, and neither of them had a college education. So my mom and dad both really wanted to give me the gift of education. They really wanted me to go to college and to have that experience, and they didn't really know where to start. So my mom thought, well, if we read to her, she'll love learning. And so the public library became this huge way for us to get materials to read. And I remember being very little and going to the library, and it was always this amazing experience where I could go in and really get whatever I wanted. And since there were everywhere else in my life, there was always limitations, right? So, you know, you had to wait till payday, or, you know, something we couldn't afford, or we were just very conscious of you know, money. And at the library, that was never an issue. You walked in, and it didn't matter if your parents were a factory worker and a housekeeper like my parents, or if they were the owner of the factory and the owner of the house that my mom was cleaning. You know, it didn't matter. They were treated exactly equal. I could have whatever I wanted and I could bring it home. And so for me, that was really incredible. And it played a part in, to me, it was a place of possibility. So I would go in, I could have whatever I wanted and I could be whatever I wanted. And there wasn't anyone telling me no. You know, I could take out 10 books. And when I got older, I could read from the older section, and I wasn't being told, no, you can't have that. So it, to me, it was always this fabulous place of possibility that stayed with me my whole life. So it's really incredible to work in one now and to lead the Pratt, especially because I think it plays that same role in the city of Baltimore, where it's really this place of possibility for the city and for all of the people who live here.
Did you always know you would be a librarian?
No, absolutely not. So I thought I was really too loud. and so I thought, oh, libraries, you know, were probably not a possibility for me. And then I interviewed for a job in an outreach department of a library doing programming, teen programming. At the time, I was young. I was in my early 20s, really early 20s. And I thought, oh, this would fit well because, you know, I know how to make programs for teens. That would be fun and interesting. And so I came to libraries through outreach and through programming. And I think that changed my experience of public libraries in general. So I've never been a shushing librarian. And although I really love to read and I love the collection of libraries, I think what drew me to working in them was being out in the communities and doing programs and taking our services out and hearing what people needed and then reflecting and responding to that through services and new programs and new collections and computers and technology. So I came at it from a different angle. I didn't come into it because I really wanted to curate a collection or because I wanted to work, you know, in the stacks or in any way, anything like that. I came to it because I was doing programming outreach, and then I got my degree, and I've worked reference in the front lines as well. But I came to it through community service, and that's sort of the spirit I've always kept with me, I think. So I didn't plan on being a librarian. It was just a happy coincidence after I graduated that I happened to interview for this job and get it, and then learned all about what really the power of libraries is for a city.
I don't think I've actually ever met a shushing librarian.
Yeah, it's such
a stereotype. I think that's such a stereotype. I'm thinking back on it, and I'm like, I literally can't ever remember meeting someone in a library who told you to be quiet. But it does permeate a library, of course. You do feel like you have to be hush-hush.
Right. Well, I think there's, I like to think of it as a feeling of reverence, mm-hmm. right? So you walk in and you feel the power of the building and of what the institution is. And people want to be respectful to that. But we're so not quiet anymore. I think if you go to any of our neighborhood branches, you know, I love to see children interacting and, you know, having, you know, playtime and moms and dads and seniors at the computer and people searching for jobs. I like to see the whole community in there together. I think it's really powerful. And I've never known a shushing librarian either, but it's definitely, I think, what people initially think of when they think of a library. And I still have people say, oh, you have to be really quiet. Shh. And I was like, yeah, it's no.
It's fine.
I mean, I'm really loud. So
so if someone didn't have your childhood experience of their parents taking them to the library and, you know, maybe they don't have a family of readers, right. I wonder, what do you think that person thinks of libraries in general? And do you, like, how do you reach out to them and try to get people into the library who might not think it's a place for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important key factor. You know, I was lucky. I didn't necessarily come from a family of readers. My dad especially tried to avoid the library, but supported my mom taking me there because they wanted me to be well-educated. So, and the librarians kind of helped me on my journey. And I think for people who don't have an experience of someone in their life being like, oh, we should go here so that you can have, you know, these resources, we've got to be proactive about letting them know what our services are. So I think if you're not a reader, it's okay. We're really welcoming to non-readers. I think on a daily basis, what our branches do, we have social workers there, you know, helping people get connected to services to help them with their situation, whether it be food insecurity or housing insecurity, you know, need for mental health services. We have social workers that can help them connect to that service. We have lawyers who can help people, if you're trying to get a job and you need to get an expungement done or you need to have some sort of other issue addressed legally, we have lawyers that can offer services that come in and work in our spaces. Our librarians and staff do job help almost every day. We have our mobile job unit. We've tried to be really proactive at the Pratt even before I came, and I hope this is going to continue well into the future. We try to be really proactive. So our mobile job unit is a big, bus of computers that goes out, and it specifically targets neighborhoods with jobs of an unemployment rate of 50% or higher. So we then park somewhere like a parking lot, a mall, wherever, and we have permission, of course, to park there. And then they just let people on and help them fill out job applications or look through job ads. Maybe the person doesn't even know where to start, so they can, set them up with an email account and help them look through job ads and then go through and do, the application or, make recommendations. So we're not waiting for those people to discover that the library has that service. We're going into their community and parking and saying, hey, we're here to help you. How can we help? And hopefully that translates into people then saying, I had a great experience on that mobile job center, and I'm going to go down to the library and get further help. And then we can connect them with all of our other services, with our programs, with our collection. We have our mobile unit that has books on it that goes out, as well as a book buggy that goes to like Wix and Head Starts. Plus, we're looking at ways to be even more nimble so that we can just be anywhere in the community, whether it's a school or a laundromat, trying to let people know that the library is for them. You don't have to be well-educated. You don't have to be an avid reader. You don't have to have any sort of credential. We're here with services that can help everybody. So, maybe you don't want the bestseller. You don't need it. That's not where you are in your life. What you need is someone to, help you figure out how to move forward into the next chapter of your life, or to help you get your child ready for kindergarten. And that's, our staff can help them do that. So we need to be proactive and be in communities where people are and not waiting for people to come in the doors. It's no longer a time where we sit around protecting our collection. And I think for a long time in libraries, the rules were very strict about usage because people wanted to access our collection, and our jobs were to protect them. And although that's still true, we want to be good stewards of our resources. Now we've got to be really proactive and say, hey, we have these resources and we want you to use them. And, we want you to come in and get them. So it's a little bit different mind frame also for libraries, but the Pratt has done it really well. And I think we're continuing to look at ways to be even more proactive about being out there.
Libraries have always been community hubs and always offered many resources. I am not a librarian, so maybe I'm wrong in this, but it seems like within the recent years, just with, fewer social services and the economy and everything, like more has fallen on libraries. Like right. We see libraries as, temporary housing during the day, right, almost for people experiencing homelessness, or, you provide these lawyers and these social workers. How has that changed, if at all, since you started working in libraries? And do libraries have to adapt as quickly as it seems like they have to me?
Yes, they do. So I think one of the things that libraries have to do and have been doing really well is just be really nimble and quick to change to disruption, because of, every time that there's a change in technology and a change in how people interact with each other online or how they access any sort of information, libraries have to be responsive to that. So I have people say to me really frequently, why does anyone need a library? Because everything you need to know is on the phone, in my pocket. And first of all, I always ask if that's actually true. Is everything you need to know really on your phone in your pocket? Because I don't think it is. A lot of people, even if you're pulling up all this information on your phone, people need help vetting what information is good information. I think we've seen a lot of that, especially in, today's current climate. There's a lot of information that's out there that just isn't legitimate and isn't good information, or it's severely biased information. So librarians are really good at helping people sort through what information is valuable in terms of making, informed decisions. We also we vet our collection. So there's some, I can't guarantee the authenticity of everything that's obviously in our nonfiction collection, but there's some layer there where someone has read a review or chose to purchase that item for some reason. Our databases tend to be scholarly peer-reviewed journals. So I think at the library you're going to get a higher level of information. But I think the disruption has really been in terms of what types of information and services the library is offering. And I think the library has always been about access. And so for a long time, access has been to print materials because that's where people were finding information primarily. That's where people were getting resources. Even if you needed to know someone's phone number, right, you had to go to a print resource. So now that that has changed, the access that we're providing is different. So it could be to e-resources. It could be to a lawyer. It could be to a social worker. We are more of a community hub because we're pulling people together. And I also remind people that even though you may have a phone with all that information in your pocket, there's still a huge portion of the population that isn't being serviced in that way, either because they can't afford a really expensive data plan if they do have a device. Maybe they do have a device, but they need to access our Wi-Fi. A lot of people don't have devices or computers at home, so they come in and use our computers. Our computer usage is still really high. And then they need someone to help them across that digital divide. They're not necessarily always aware of how to download things onto devices or how to look at settings. And we're here to help them do that as well. So I think, yes, we have to change and be constantly adaptive. I always, even in buildings, I'm telling staff, don't build a building for the next 50 years. You know, maybe your building is for 50 years, but the layout needs to be able to change in five. Because whether we're doing makerspaces today, we might not be doing makerspaces tomorrow. We might have desktop computers today, but we probably won't have desktop computers in 10 years. So we have to be really flexible and really adaptive. To me, it's really exciting because it means that we're always kind of on that cusp and edge. And so, you know, I don't look at it as a threat to libraries. I look at it as an excellent opportunity for us to keep moving forward and make sure we're bringing the city along with us.
In some ways, we're in a very anti-intellectualism time, anti-elite time. I mean, we've seen this play out in politics, in higher education. Do people value libraries and do people value those resources that you're offering? And if not, is that frustrating? I mean, this is like, I'm just a huge reader and like, I think someone who is really sees the value in things like that. But I wonder, you know, just what a random person on the street is feeling in this day and age.
So I think it depends on where you are and who that random person is. I think overall, I can tell you that the Pratt Library in the city of Baltimore is definitely valued. Every place I go, someone has a Pratt story they want to tell me from their childhood. They want to talk about what branch was theirs. We're not serving the elite in most of our branch buildings. We're serving people who are falling through all kinds of safety nets, through the cracks. And then we are serving the elite, too. And the great thing is we're doing it in the same building. So I really value the fact that I can go into, let's say, the Govins branch, which is kind of borders Homeland and Govinstown and that Belvedere Square, York area. So I can go in there on any given Saturday, and there's a huge population of people from all of the surrounding communities, and sometimes even further. I know people who drive from other parts of the city to go there for their baby time or toddler time. And then you're going to see people, you know, from Homeland in there maybe checking out, you know, gardening or home repair books or meeting in their friends groups. Or you're also going to see people in there looking for jobs and, you know, trying to figure out how they're going to get food or how they're going to get housing. And to have all those people in the same space working together, I think, creates the kind of momentum a city needs to become cohesive. So you start to view that space as our space as opposed to just the space for the people on this side of the road or this people on that side of the road, right? It's our space. It's our public space, our community space. And like I said, we serve everyone from the homeless person who needs to access really basic services and needs a warm place or a cool place to be in the afternoon and has to have help creating an email address to get services, to someone who, you know, is undertaking a massive home project and wants a home renovation book. So in that way, I do think the library is valued by a large swath of the community, more so than probably any other institution. And I think that's really important and powerful. Of course, I do think that there are people who think that the library's time has come, but I think those people don't use us anyway and haven't been in a building in a long time. And so I would hope that they would come back and, you know, check it out. But, you know, you're not going to win everyone all the time.
Do you think the Pratt system, well, how does the Pratt system's role in Baltimore compare to the library system's role in the communities you've worked in the past?
That's a great question. I think it's both similar and different, of course. And I would say the similar comes from, I've worked in libraries in Oklahoma and Houston, in Youngstown, Ohio, which is where I was prior to this job, and now here in the city of Baltimore. So really different cities in different parts of the country. And I would say that the similarity is that the value and the services we're offering are really sort of the same in spirit. So maybe a service that is really crucial here in Baltimore wasn't needed in Houston or wasn't needed in Ohio, but the idea of it is the same, right? So every library I've worked in, large urban libraries, for the most part, have been really responsive to the communities they service. I think differences, you know, come with budgets and structure and who the community is in particular. So in Ohio, we had the ability to build large sprawling buildings in the suburbs. You know, we're not going to do that in the city of Baltimore because it's a city and you're not going to have a parking lot for 90 cars because that's unheard of and wouldn't make any sense, where it might in a large suburban area serving, you know, a large surrounding population. So everything's going to be a little bit different, but the similarities is being responsive to the community. I think the big difference to me for the Pratt is I don't know that any other library system I've worked for has been quite so cherished. I think every library system I've worked for has been really well revered and well loved. Houston is, I think, the largest library system in Texas. It's in the top five for systems in the country. Their director is actually from Baltimore, and they are, you know, incredible. They're award-winning. Youngstown, you know, people would come up to me and say, "I love my library," just randomly at the grocery store. So obviously it was really loved by its community and really cherished. But Baltimore feels different in the way that it loves its library. And it's the services we are providing here in the city are really critical services. And you walk away with the feeling that we did something today that really made a difference in someone's life. We also get incredibly great authors and speakers here because of our sort of prime geographical location. So I think that's also something that's been great. So we have all kinds of big names coming from all over the country, and we are able to have really timely, topical speakers, whether it was April Ryan or Chris Matthews. You know, it's just, those are pretty incredible to be a part of, and they get 600, 400 people coming to them. And that's definitely unique because, you know, it's great to be here and be able to pull so many people in. And I think just those stories of, I remember the library, you know, I went to library number 2 and it's not here anymore, but this is what we did. Or I was talking recently to a group about the Central Library and the renovation, and there was a gentleman in the audience who actually remembered going there when he was a child, when he was 7, into the children's room through the gates. And he had this wonderful story about how he remembered there was this marble and it was really imposing. And then you got in and you saw the goldfish and it seemed so child friendly after these, you know, big imposing, you know, gates and marble. And so it was a great story that he could remember, you know, that far back to when we had first, I think it was in the 40s that he had gone in there as a child. So it was really fabulous to hear that story and hear him speaking of that. And I think that that's what strikes me here is so many people have a personal connection to the Pratt in particular.
What surprised you when you took this job and when you came to Baltimore, and what were some of the challenges?
Well, I think honestly, part of what surprised me is those personal stories and really how small of a city Baltimore is, even though it's a large city.
You learned that quickly.
Yeah.
A cliche, but it's true.
It is. So it's like really a connected city. I tell people my first night in Baltimore, we were staying at a hotel, and there was this little cafe right by the hotel because our house wasn't ready yet. So we were going over to this cafe to get dinner, and we had our 2 young children with us, and everybody's like dirty and grumpy, and you know, like I have a ponytail and like, I don't know, overalls or something. Like, you know, we've been moving all day. I was exhausted. And the kids were super fidgety. And we go in this cafe and there was like these little toys that the cafe had. And my daughter picked a couple up and was pretending they were maracas. And she was like doing this like interpretive dance in the cafe or something, kind of just being boisterous and a little loud. And I was like, oh, you know, you keep it down, keep it down. Because it wasn't too busy. And there was these two women sitting behind us at a table. And I turned around to apologize. And then I turned back around to my husband and instantly sent him a text message that said, that's Carla Hayden sitting behind us. So,
oh my gosh. And it's the librarian hot.
Yeah. I mean, it was just so weird because it was our first night and we just randomly went to this cafe and directly behind us was Dr. Carla Hayden. And I thought, my husband kept saying, like, we were texting because I, you know, I don't know what to do. And he's like, are you sure? And I was like, I'm 100% sure. Like, I would know her, you know, I'm positive. And so I finally introduced myself. And she, of course, she was lovely and gracious. But that sort of, to me, just sort of made that. I was so surprised about how Baltimore is very, it's just a small city for such a big city. And, you know, there's little connections everywhere. It's like there's 6 degrees to every person. Yes. I meet. And I mean, I think that that's really interesting and can be really great. I also think I was surprised by how many neighborhoods there are and how specific each neighborhood is. So when we're looking at libraries and we're looking at services, I think that that's really important to understand and to understand the history of the city and how it impacts the services being delivered in each community. And I didn't realize when I took the job how many neighborhoods they were and how specific they were. So how Sandtown, Winchester might be different than Penn North, or, you know, Southeast Anchor might have a completely different feel, and why we're going to do certain services at Southeast Anchor that we're not going to do at Orleans Street, even though their geographic proximity is close. They're different neighborhoods with different needs. And so I think that that was something that surprised me and offers us a little bit of a challenge. We also are challenged in terms of our branches. Just to be honest, there's 22 or 21 branches, 22 locations with Central. And some of them are really old and need serious upgrading in order to move us, you know, further into the future. And I think that that happens because, you know, by the time we finish remodeling all of those buildings, I'll be sitting here going, well, we have these branches over here that need, you know, work and remodeling, because it's the cycle of how, you know, a building life is. And with that many buildings, you're constantly doing projects. But I'd really like to see each of our branches in each of our neighborhoods. We have some really beautiful branches, like Waverly is gorgeous. And our Pennsylvania Avenue branch is really nice, our Southeast Anchor branch, Orleans Street. But then we have some that we're getting ready to remodel, like our Clifton branch, which we just expanded our hours. So up until now, it was only open 17 and a half hours, but it's tiny, it's older. I just think every neighborhood deserves to walk into a building that is bright, welcoming, well-organized, well-staffed with welcoming people, and it should feel rich. It doesn't matter what neighborhood you are in. You should walk into a very rich experience in your local library. So that's something I think is a bit of a challenge for us, just in terms of funding and capacity to address them as quickly as we might like. But I think we'll get there. And then I'm in the middle of this renovation of Central, which I walked into and is an incredible project over 3 years. So that's both a great challenge and what an amazing blessing and opportunity. And we did just expand our hours by over 30%. So
I wanted to talk about Dr. Carla Hayden. Okay. I know that the search committee, who I guess hired you,
yes,
or found you, yes,
yeah.
I know that they said in The Sun that, of course, no one was looking for a Dr. Hayden clone. But I wonder what it felt like to you filling such large shoes.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's so funny because I've had people say, oh, it must be so hard to follow such a legend. And I'm like, oh, I just really didn't think about it until just now. But I myself have had a lot of respect and admiration for Dr. Carla Hayden. And she's had an incredible career. And I've watched the Pratt for most of my professional career. The director I worked for in Houston, she would send the compass to me, you know, every month to look at. And so I was always like, oh, what is the Pratt doing? I should check out the Pratt. So when the position opened, first of all, everyone was thrilled that Dr. Hayden was chosen as Librarian of Congress, because it's just huge for basically every reason there could be. She was the first, you know, African-American, the first female, first actual degree-holding librarian. So it's cool in a number of ways, right? And so I was excited along with everyone else for that. And then, of course, I instantly started to think, oh, well, they're going to need a new CEO. And when I saw the posting, I almost didn't apply, but my husband said, well, I don't want to listen to you talk about how you could have been the CEO of the Pratt for the next 10 years. So just do us a favor and apply. And if you don't get it, you know, and you could walk away. It's like, oh, yeah, you're right. I will. So I really felt like it was kind of a whirlwind. Like I applied. I really didn't expect it to go anywhere. And then before I knew it, I was sitting in an interview with the Baltimore Sun because I'd just been hired. And it was like, I don't know how this happened. This is crazy. And so following Dr. Carla Hayden is really great in a lot of ways because she's built the library system into the legend that it is in the city and did a great job. And I would much rather prefer that than walking into a situation where, you know, the library is not, hasn't been in great hands and hasn't been well thought of in the community. So it's really only positive. And of course, they are huge shoes to fill, but you know, we're different people, we're different leadership styles, we're different focuses, the times, you know, that we're working in will be different. So I'm confident that it'll all be fine.
We kind of talked about it with the children's books, I guess. But yeah, I wonder, like you said, Dr. Hayden was a first in more ways than one, becoming right. The Librarian of Congress. I wonder, you know, not to pigeonhole you with this question, but as a female librarian, what impact do you think visibility has, especially on younger children? And to you, did Dr. Hayden becoming the Librarian of Congress, was it symbolic in any kind of larger way?
Of course, I think it was symbolic in a larger way for everyone. You know, it's incredible to have the first African-American female librarian of Congress and to have her have come from the Pratt. I think for young children, it's really important to see themselves and figures of leadership and of power. So I think that for the Pratt, that was really amazing to have her as the director. Anna Curry before her was the first African-American director. So, you know, obviously I'm a break from that. I'm Caucasian female. But I think for me, it's about the work that we're doing and the work that I'm doing. So I'm hoping to keep uplifting people. I mean, it will be obviously in a different way, but there's lots of ways that I think we can uplift the city. And I think for me, I wasn't, you know, I'm first generation. My parents didn't go to college. So offering support and education to the city and the community is something that is really important to me. And so I think my work is to just keep doing the work of uplifting everyone in the city of Baltimore. And I hope that I can do that. And I feel confident that I can. But certainly Dr. Hayden's selection for the Library of Congress was a symbolic one and I think a really positive one.
Do you have time to read anymore?
No. No, I do. I'm a mother and I have two young children, so I'm spending time reading. We're reading Wrinkle in Time right now because we just went and saw the movie, so we're reading that together at night. So to some degree, I read children's books, but I still read on my own. I have a stack of books on my bedside table as we speak. And actually, one of them is the historical architecture of Baltimore. And another is, I think it's called Not in My Town.
Not in My Neighborhood.
Not in My Neighborhood,
yes. That's a great book. That's a Baltimore classic.
Yes. So I feel like that's something that was a must read for moving to Baltimore. And I just finished Little Fires Everywhere.
Which, I have bought that, but I haven't read it yet.
It's fabulous. Okay. I really loved it. Yeah, it's great. It was one of the books that I read in like two nights. I just finished An American Marriage by Tayari Jones because we had her recently. And that was also a great book. I highly recommend it. It was also a pretty fast read, but very thought provoking.
You're still reading. You say no.
I know. So I think for me, I feel like I've taken a little bit of a downturn. But I'm reading more fiction maybe than anything else because I kind of want an escape. So if I wake up at 2 a.m. and I have, you know, work on my mind, if I slip into Little Fires Everywhere and it's, you know, this suburban Cleveland situation, I'm not thinking about the elevators and the Central Library. And so it's great to be able to have fiction to do that, to take you away from your daily life. And then I'm reading a book right now called Counterculture that's about organizational culture. So I read a little bit for work. But I'm doing a lot of fiction reading more than anything lately.
So beyond the renovations, the branches, all of the tangible things that you're working on. What is your ambition for the Pratt Library in a larger sense?
So I want us to really continue to be that beacon for the city of Baltimore. And I want to make sure that it doesn't end with this generation, but that it keeps going. A huge point for me is to remove barriers to access. So I think we still have a lot of ways we can make our buildings and our collections and our services more accessible to the city of Baltimore, regardless of, you know, race, income, gender, religion, just as Enoch Pratt's vision had stated, because the Pratt's really unique in that it was founded on the idea of it shall be for all, as opposed to, you know, a library that was just meant for a white community. So I think I hope that Baltimore can continue to embrace the Pratt in the same way, and that we can keep being that place of possibility, that place of yes, that place of course you can, and how can we help you? And we're going to have to be really flexible and nimble to keep that moving forward. And I think we can do it.
Heidi, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Heidi Daniel. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. Female Trouble is available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and everywhere else. We're also on Twitter at FML Trouble. You can find more at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back soon. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. In 2016, Enoch Pratt Free Library President Carla Hayden was selected to head the Library of Congress. Heidi Daniel was selected to replace her, stepping in to manage the 22-branch system. Heidi began her career in children's and teen programming in Oklahoma City and Houston before moving into library administration. Before coming to Baltimore, she was the director of Ohio's Youngstown and Mahoning County system. Right now, she is overseeing an $115 million renovation of the Pratt's historic central branch. Heidi talked about the role of libraries in both communities and in her life. Here's our conversation. Do you remember the first book you fell in love with?
I do remember the first books I fell in love with, and they were really the shoes series. So ballet shoes, circus shoes, or children's books. And I remember being young and just thinking they were fascinating because the children's lives were so different from mine. And, you know, I wasn't going to dance on stage in the ballet anywhere. And it was just fascinating. And then I think that was quickly followed by I read every Ramona Quimby book.
Yes, I loved those.
Yeah, those
yes.
were the best, right? Yes. And I remember just sitting there, and I wished that she was my best friend. And I really wanted to hang out with her. I was about her age, I guess, when I was reading those. So the Ramona Quimby books really grabbed me. And then, you know, I went right into, like, Harriet the Spy. And I think I went through this brief, weird period where I wanted to be Harriet the Spy. So I would, like, walk around my neighborhood, like, pretending to spy on people and like taking little notes in my little yes. notebook. So
it was so cool. She went in, like, didn't she go in the elevator shaft or the rafters somewhere to spy on people?
Yeah.
I remember
she was
thinking,
like,
that was so cool.
Yeah. And I mean, it was stuff that would definitely get you in trouble and maybe even arrested. Like, I remember she would like peer in her neighbor's windows. And I mean, you know, you can't really do that, but I'm pretty sure it's frowned upon. But I loved that whole idea of just the way she was interested in all these people's lives. And I think, you know, that was just really relatable as a kid. And I was an only child. So I think my best friends tended to be people who were in books and weren't real. But that was great. And I loved it. And then as I progressed throughout school, obviously the types of literature I was reading changed. And I think I remember, I guess I think it was around my senior year of high school, I read The Color Purple. And that was, again, a whole other game changer for me. It was just such a poignant book and full of, again, experiences so far away from my own experiences, but really relatable. I think every book you find a character and you're like, oh, I see myself in that person. And so it's always been amazing to me to have this experience where I'm looking at an experience and a person and a situation that's so different from me and maybe something I've never been in. But there's something about that person or a character that you can go, oh, but I totally get why she feels that way, because I would feel that way. Or that experience, you know, that moment she's having right there, or that thought she's having is something that I might have, or I've had about something different. So the way I read started changing, and I started really being interested in also reading diverse books because I was so fascinated with this ability to get into the experience of other people and learn about the world that they inhabited. So it's just taken me on a great journey. But the first books I think I fell in love with were definitely the Shoe books, and then followed by Ramona Quimby and Harriet the Spy. Those just really stick out from my childhood.
That's interesting that you took to reading diverse books early, because I feel like now a lot of people make an effort to do so. They're like, you know, they look back at what they've read and it's all white men or something, right, and they're right. Like, oh, wow, I should really read more books by women. And it's for the exact reasons that you're saying. So right. Did that always come naturally to you?
Well, I don't know if it came naturally to me. I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, so far above everyone that, oh, yeah, I've been reading diverse books before it was cool. But I do think, I don't remember why I picked up Alice Walker's The Color Purple, but it was the first book I remember reading that was, I think, by a woman of color. And then I read The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. And again, different experience, but so very much real people and real thoughts and feelings. So I think I was also a women's studies major in undergraduate, so I was inclined to read diversely and to read a lot of women writers and to read writers from different countries and of different ethnicities and different races than myself. And now it's definitely something that I try to consciously do. I think when I was younger, I wasn't really being conscientious about it. I think I was just reading what appealed to me. So books that appealed to me happened to have some diversity to them, which is great. But I wasn't sitting around thinking, well, I want to make sure I'm not reading just white men. Now it's something that I'm very much wanting to be conscientious about because of the position I hold and the city we live in and the world around us. And it's something I want to instill in my children. And so it's now starting over with, for example, my daughter, who's 7, and she's an avid reader, and we go to the bookstore. And I want to make sure that she's picking out books with, you know, protagonists and main characters that aren't the same color as her or from the same country as her, so that she's seeing people in lead roles from the beginning that are different than her, and that she views that as normal as opposed to, you know, something she's got to search for. And it's really, it can be a challenge because there's a lot of books, like, you're not always looking for an issue book, right? Like, you kind of want a book, like recently she was reading a series about called Jada. I can't remember what the series names. I should have looked it up before I mentioned it. But she's an elementary school student. She leads a science club and she's real popular and she happens to be African-American. But it's not, it's about a, you know, an 8-year-old girl doing 8-year-old girl things. And she just happens to be African-American. And I think that's where I'm trying to be with my daughter right now, is finding those types of books where she sees other people in lead roles as well. And it's great because I know that those books weren't out there when I was a child. You know, it was Ramona Quimby was really similar to my experience in many ways. So it's great that we have some more options. And I think the publishing industry is really aware of the need and desire. Obviously, we need diverse books as a big movement in publishing right now. It's also a great website if people are looking for diverse books to access too. So
it kind of speaks to the larger conversation about, like, in criticism or in publishing, how sometimes it seems like, you know, men write the quote-unquote universal story, and then if you are in a minority of any kind, it is sometimes pigeonholed as, like, a domestic book or, you know, a book about civil rights when in fact women and people of color and whoever it may be are just writing their stories, and it can just be a kid's picture book with, you know, with an African-American protagonist. So,
exactly.
So you have seen a lot of evolution in that in,
yeah,
in your
I
life,
mean, I think we have a long way to go, but I think it's definitely something that people are aware of, and there is a movement out there to change it, and I think that it is, you know, moving in that direction. I think we as, you know, readers and as consumers need to be conscientious about making those choices and finding those titles and supporting those writers and buying them from your bookstore, checking them out from your library, so that more and more of those titles are there and are available. I do think we have a long way to go. You know, I can think of some books that I bought for my daughter that were great and that were spot on with that, but I still think there's not enough of them. It's still much easier for me just to get a book with a main character who is, you know, white, middle class child, you know, character. So I think we have a long way to go, but I do think it's improved since I was a child, for sure. And I am very hopeful that it's going to keep improving. And I think we just need to keep, you know, requesting it and being thoughtful about it.
What role did libraries play in your childhood?
So libraries played a huge role in my childhood. My parents adopted me when I was an infant, and neither of them had a college education. So my mom and dad both really wanted to give me the gift of education. They really wanted me to go to college and to have that experience, and they didn't really know where to start. So my mom thought, well, if we read to her, she'll love learning. And so the public library became this huge way for us to get materials to read. And I remember being very little and going to the library, and it was always this amazing experience where I could go in and really get whatever I wanted. And since there were everywhere else in my life, there was always limitations, right? So, you know, you had to wait till payday, or, you know, something we couldn't afford, or we were just very conscious of you know, money. And at the library, that was never an issue. You walked in, and it didn't matter if your parents were a factory worker and a housekeeper like my parents, or if they were the owner of the factory and the owner of the house that my mom was cleaning. You know, it was didn't matter. They were treated exactly equal. I could have whatever I wanted, and I could bring it home. And so for me, that was really incredible. And it played a part in, to me, it was a place of possibility. So I would go in, I could have whatever I wanted, and I could be whatever I wanted, and there wasn't anyone telling me no. You know, I could take out 10 books, and when I got older, I could read from the older section, and I wasn't being told, no, you can't have that. So it, to me, it was always a fabulous place of possibility that stayed with me my whole life. So it's really incredible to work in one now and to lead the Pratt, especially because I think it plays that same role in the city of Baltimore, where it's really this place of possibility for the city and for all of the people who live here.
Did you always know you would be a librarian?
No, absolutely not. So I thought I was really too loud. and so I thought, oh, libraries, you know, were probably not a possibility for me. And then I interviewed for a job in an outreach department of a library doing programming, teen programming. At the time, I was young. I was in my early 20s, really early 20s. And I thought, yo, this would fit well because, you know, I know how to make programs for teens. That would be fun and interesting. And so I came to libraries through outreach and through programming. And I think that changed my experience of public libraries in general. So I've never been a shushing librarian. And although I really love to read and I love the collection of libraries, I think what drew me to working in them was being out in the communities and doing programs and taking our services out and hearing what people needed and then reflecting and responding to that through services and new programs and new collections and computers and technology. So I came at it from a different angle. I didn't come into it because I really wanted to curate a collection or because I wanted to work, you know, in the stacks or in any way, anything like that. I came to it because I was doing programming outreach, and then I got my degree, and I've worked reference in the front lines as well. But I came to it through community service, and that's sort of the spirit I've always kept with me, I think. So I didn't plan on being a librarian. It was just a happy coincidence after I graduated that I happened to interview for this job and get it, and then learned all about what really the power of libraries is for a city.
I don't think I've actually ever met a shushing librarian.
Yeah, it's such
a stereotype. I think that's such a stereotype. I'm thinking back on it, and I'm like, I literally can't ever remember meeting someone in a library who told you to be quiet. But it does permeate a library, of course. You do right. feel like you have to be hush-hush. But.
Right. Well, I think there's... I like to think of it as a feeling of reverence, mm-hmm. right? So you walk in and you feel the power of the building and of what the institution is. And people want to be respectful to that. But we're so not quiet anymore. I think if you go to any of our neighborhood branches, you know, I love to see children interacting and, you know, having, you know, playtime and moms and dads and seniors at the computer and people searching for jobs. I like to see the whole community in there together. I think it's really powerful. And I've never known a Shushing librarian either, but it's definitely, I think, what people initially think of when they think of a library. And I still have people say, oh, you have to be really quiet. Shh. And I was like, yeah, it's no.
It's fine.
I mean, I'm really loud. So
so if someone didn't have your childhood experience of their parents taking them to the library and, you know, maybe they don't have a family of readers, right. I wonder, what do you think that person thinks of libraries in general? And do you, like, how do you reach out to them and try to get people into the library who might not think it's a place for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important key factor. You know, I was lucky. I didn't necessarily come from a family of readers. My dad especially tried to avoid the library, but supported my mom taking me there because they wanted me to be well-educated. So, and the librarians kind of helped me on my journey. And I think for people who don't have an experience of someone in their life being like, oh, we should go here so that you can have, you know, these resources, we've got to be proactive about letting them know what our services are. So I think if you're not a reader, it's okay. We're really welcoming to non-readers. I think on a daily basis, what our branches do, we have social workers there, you know, helping people get connected to services to help them with their situation, whether it be food insecurity or housing insecurity, you know, need for mental health services. We have social workers that can help them connect to that service. We have lawyers who can help people if you're trying to get a job and you need to get an expungement done or you need to have, you know, some sort of other issue addressed legally. We have lawyers that can offer services that come in and work in our spaces. Our librarians and staff do job help almost every day. We have our mobile job unit. We've tried to be really proactive at the Pratt even before I came, and I hope this is going to continue, you know, well into the future. We try to be really proactive. So our mobile job unit is a big, you know, bus of computers that goes out, and it specifically targets neighborhoods with jobs like or of an unemployment rate of 50% or higher. So we then park somewhere like a parking lot, a mall, wherever, and we have permission, of course, to park there. And then they just let people on and help them fill out job applications or look through job ads. Maybe the person doesn't even know where to start, so they can, you know, set them up with an email account and help them look through job ads and then go through and do, you know, the application or, you know, make recommendations. So we're not waiting for those people to discover that the library has that service. We're going into their community and parking and saying, hey, we're here to help you. How can we help? And hopefully that translates into people then saying, you know, I had a great experience on that mobile job center and I'm going to go down to the library and get further help. And then we can connect them with all of our other services, with our programs, with our collection. We have our mobile unit that has books on it that goes out, as well as a book buggy that goes to like Wix and Head Starts. Plus, we're looking at ways to be even more nimble so that we can just be anywhere in the community, whether it's a school or a laundromat, trying to let people know that the library is for them. You don't have to be well-educated. You don't have to be an avid reader. You don't have to have any sort of credential. We're here with services that can help everybody. So, you know, maybe you don't want the bestseller. You don't need it. That's not where you are in your life. What you need is someone to, you know, help you figure out how to move forward into the next chapter of your life, or to help you get your child ready for kindergarten. And that's, our staff can help them do that. So we need to be proactive and be in communities where people are and not waiting for people to come in the doors. You know, it's no longer a time where we sit around protecting our collection. And I think for a long time in libraries, the rules were very strict about usage because people wanted to access our collection and our jobs were to protect them. And although that's still true, we want to be good stewards of our resources. Now we've got to be really proactive and say, hey, we have these resources and we want you to use them. And, you know, we want you to come in and get them. So it's a little bit different mind frame also for libraries. But The Pratt has done it really well, and I think we're continuing to look at ways to be even more proactive about being out there.
Libraries have always been community hubs and always offered many resources. And, you know, I am not a librarian, so maybe I'm wrong in this, but it seems like within the recent years, just with, you know, fewer social services and the economy and everything, like more has fallen on libraries. Like we see libraries as, you know, temporary housing during the day almost for people experiencing homelessness, or, you know, you provide these lawyers and these social workers. How has that changed, if at all, since you started working in libraries? And do libraries have to adapt as quickly as it seems like they have to me?
Yes, they do. So I think one of the things that libraries have to do and have been doing really well is just be really nimble and quick to change to disruption because of, you know, every time that there's a change in technology and a change in how people interact with each other online or how they access any sort of information, libraries have to be responsive to that. So I have people say to me really frequently, why does anyone need a library? Because everything you need to know is on the phone, in my pocket. And first of all, I always ask if that's actually true. Is everything you need to know really on your phone in your pocket? Because I don't think it is. A lot of people, even if you're pulling up all this information on your phone, people need help vetting what information is good information. I think we've seen a lot of that, especially in, you know, today's current climate. There's a lot of information that's out there that just isn't legitimate and isn't good information, or it's severely biased information. So librarians are really good at helping people sort through what information is valuable in terms of making, you know, informed decisions. We also we vet our collection. So there's some, I can't guarantee the authenticity of everything that's obviously in our nonfiction collection, but there's some layer there where someone has read a review or chose to purchase that item for some reason. Our databases tend to be scholarly peer-reviewed journals. So I think at the library, you're going to get a higher level of information. But I think the disruption has really been in terms of what types of information and services the library is offering. And I think the library has always been about access. And so for a long time, access has been to print materials because that's where people were finding information primarily. That's where people were getting resources. Even if you needed to know someone's phone number, right, you had to go to a print resource. So now that that has changed, the access that we're providing is different. So it could be to e-resources. It could be to a lawyer. It could be to a social worker. We are more of a community hub because we're pulling people together. And I also remind people that even though you may have a phone with all that information in your pocket, there's still a huge portion of the population that isn't being serviced in that way, either because they can't afford a really expensive data plan, if they do have a device. Maybe they do have a device, but they need to access our Wi-Fi. A lot of people don't have devices or computers at home, so they come in and use our computers. Our computer usage is still really high. And then they need someone to help them across that digital divide. They're not necessarily always aware of how to download things onto devices or how to look at settings, and we're here to help them do that as well. So I think, yes, we have to change and be constantly adaptive. I always, even in buildings, I'm telling staff, don't build a building for the next 50 years. You know, maybe your building is for 50 years, but the layout needs to be able to change in 5. Because whether we're doing makerspaces today, we might not be doing makerspaces tomorrow. We might have desktop computers today, but we probably won't have desktop computers in 10 years. So we have to be really flexible and really adaptive. To me, it's really exciting because it means that we're always kind of on that cusp and edge. And so, you know, I don't look at it as a threat to libraries. I look at it as an excellent opportunity for us to keep moving forward and make sure we're bringing the city along with us.
In some ways, we're in a very anti-intellectualism time, anti-elite time. I mean, we've seen this play out in politics, in higher education. Do people value libraries, and do people value those resources that you're offering? And if not, is that frustrating? I mean, this is like, I'm just a huge reader, and like, I think someone who is really sees the value in things like that. But I wonder, you know, just what a random person on the street is feeling in this day and age.
So I think it depends on where you are and who that random person is. I think overall, I can tell you that the Pratt Library in the city of Baltimore is definitely valued. Every place I go, someone has a Pratt story they want to tell me from their childhood. They want to talk about what branch was theirs. We're not serving the elite in most of our branch buildings. We're serving people who are falling through all kinds of safety nets, through the cracks. And then we are serving the elite, too. And the great thing is we're doing it in the same building. So I really value the fact that I can go into, let's say, the Govins branch, which is kind of borders Homeland and Govinstown and that Belvedere Square, York area. So I can go in there on any given Saturday, and there's a huge population of people from all of the surrounding communities, and sometimes even further. I know people who drive from other parts of the city to go there for their baby time or toddler time. And then you're going to see people, you know, from Homeland in there maybe checking out, you know, gardening or home repair books or meeting in their friends groups. Or you're also going to see people in there looking for jobs and, you know, trying to figure out how they're going to get food or how they're going to get housing. And to have all those people in the same space working together, I think, creates the kind of momentum a city needs to become cohesive. So you start to view that space as our space as opposed to just the space for the people on this side of the road or this people on that side of the road, right? It's our space. It's our public space, our community space. And like I said, we serve everyone from the homeless person who needs to access really basic services and needs a warm place or a cool place to be in the afternoon and has to have help creating an email address to get services, to someone who, you know, is undertaking a massive home project and wants a home renovation book. So in that way, I do think the library is valued by a large swath of the community, more so than probably any other institution. And I think that's really important and powerful. Of course, I do think that there are people who think that the library's time has come, but I think those people don't use us anyway and haven't been in a building in a long time. And so I would hope that they would come back and, you know, check it out. But, you know, you're not going to win everyone all the time.
Do you think the Pratt system, well, how does the Pratt system's role in Baltimore compare to the library system's role in the communities you've worked in the past?
That's a great question. I think it's both similar and different, of course. And I would say the similar comes from, I've worked in libraries in Oklahoma and Houston, in Youngstown, Ohio, which is where I was prior to this job, and now here in the city of Baltimore. So really different cities in different parts of the country. And I would say that the similarity is that the value and the services we're offering are really sort of the same in spirit. So maybe a service that is really crucial here in Baltimore wasn't needed in Houston or wasn't needed in Ohio, but the idea of it is the same, right? So every library I've worked in, large urban libraries, for the most part, have been really responsive to the communities they service. I think differences, you know, come with budgets and structure and who the community is in particular. So in Ohio, we had the ability to build large sprawling buildings in the suburbs. You know, we're not going to do that in the city of Baltimore because it's a city and you're not going to have a parking lot for 90 cars because that's unheard of and wouldn't make any sense, where it might in a large suburban area serving, you know, a large surrounding population. So everything's going to be a little bit different, but the similarities is being responsive to the community. I think the big difference to me for the Pratt is I don't know that any other library system I've worked for has been quite so cherished. I think every library system I've worked for has been really well revered and well loved. Houston is, I think, the largest library system in Texas. It's in the top five for systems in the country. Their director is actually from Baltimore. And they are, you know, incredible. They're award-winning. Youngstown, you know, people would come up to me and say, I love my library, just randomly at the grocery store. So obviously it was really loved by its community and really cherished. But Baltimore feels different in the way that it loves its library. And it's the services we are providing here in the city are really critical services. And you walk away with the feeling that we did something today that really made a difference in someone's life. We also get incredibly great authors and speakers here because of our sort of prime geographical location. So I think that's also something that's been great. So, we have all kinds of big names coming from all over the country, and we were able to have really timely, topical speakers, whether it was April Ryan or Chris Matthews. It's just, those are pretty incredible to be a part of, and they get 600, 400 people coming to them. And that's definitely unique because, it's great to be here and be able to pull so many people in. And I think just those stories of, I remember the library, I went to library number 2 and it's not here anymore, but this is what we did. Or I was talking recently to a group about the Central Library and the renovation, and there was a gentleman in the audience who actually remembered going there when he was a child, when he was 7, into the children's room through the gates. And he had this wonderful story about how he remembered there was this marble and it was really imposing. And then you got in and you saw the goldfish and it seemed so child friendly after these, big imposing, gates and marble. And so it was a great story that he could remember, that far back to when we had first, I think it was not, it was in the 40s that he had gone in there as a child. So it was really fabulous to hear that story and hear him speaking of that. And I think that that's what strikes me here, is so many people have a personal connection to the Pratt in particular.
What surprised you when you took this job and when you came to Baltimore, and what were some of the challenges?
Well, I think honestly, part of what surprised me is those personal stories and really how small of a city Baltimore is, even though it's a large city.
You learned that quickly. Yeah. It's a cliche, but it's true.
It is. So it's like really a connected city. I tell people my first night in Baltimore, we were staying at a hotel, and there was this little cafe right by the hotel because our house wasn't ready yet. So we were going over to this cafe to get dinner, and we had our 2 young children with us, and everybody's like dirty and grumpy, and like I have a ponytail and like I don't know, overalls or something, like we've been moving all day, I was exhausted, and the kids were super fidgety. And we go in this cafe, and there was like these little toys that the cafe had, and my daughter picked a couple up and was pretending they were maracas, and she was like doing this like interpretive dance in the cafe or something, kind of just being boisterous and a little loud. And I was like, oh, you keep it down, because it wasn't too busy. And there was these 2 women sitting behind us at a table, and I turned around to apologize. And then I turned back around to my husband and instantly sent him a text message that said, that's Carla Hayden sitting behind us. So,
oh my gosh. And it's the librarian hot.
Yeah. I mean, it was just so weird because it was our first night and we just randomly went to this cafe, and directly behind us was Dr. Carla Hayden. And I thought, my husband kept saying, like, we were texting because I don't know what to do. And he's like, are you sure? And I was like, I'm 100% sure. Like, I would know her, I'm positive. And so I finally introduced myself. And she, of course, she was lovely and gracious. But that sort of, to me, just sort of made that, I was so surprised about how Baltimore is very, it's just a small city for such a big city. And, there's little connections everywhere. It's like there's 6 degrees to every person.
Yes.
I meet. And I mean, I think that that's really interesting and can be really great. I also think I was surprised by how many neighborhoods there are and how specific each neighborhood is. So when we're looking at libraries and we're looking at services, I think that that's really important to understand, and to understand the history of the city and how it impacts the services being delivered in each community. And I didn't realize when I took the job how many neighborhoods they were and how specific they were. So how Sandtown, Winchester might be different than Penn North, or, Southeast Anchor might have a completely different feel, and why we're going to do certain services at Southeast Anchor that we're not going to do at Orleans Street, even though their geographic proximity is close. They're different neighborhoods with different needs. And so I think that that was something that surprised me and offers us a little bit of a challenge. We also are challenged in terms of our branches. Just to be honest, there's 22 or 21 branches, 22 locations with Central. And some of them are really old and need serious upgrading in order to move us, further into the future. And I think that that happens because, by the time we finish remodeling all of those buildings, I'll be sitting here going, well, we have these branches over here that need, work and remodeling, because it's the cycle of how you know, a building life is. And with that many buildings, you're constantly doing projects. But I'd really like to see each of our branches in each of our neighborhoods. We have some really beautiful branches, like Waverly is gorgeous. And our Pennsylvania Avenue branch is really nice, our Southeast Anchor branch, Orleans Street. But then we have some that we're getting ready to remodel, like our Clifton branch, which we just expanded our hours. So up until now, it was only open 17 and a half hours, but it's tiny, it's older. I just think every neighborhood deserves to walk into a building that is bright, welcoming, well-organized, well-staffed with welcoming people, and it should feel rich. It doesn't matter what neighborhood you are in. You should walk into a very rich experience in your local library. So that's something I think is a bit of a challenge for us, just in terms of funding and capacity to address them as quickly as we might like. But I think we'll get there. And then I'm in the middle of this renovation of Central, which I walked into and is an incredible project over 3 years. So that's both a great challenge and what an amazing blessing and opportunity. And we did just expand our hours by over 30%. So
I wanted to talk about Dr. Carla Hayden. Okay. I know that the search committee, who I guess hired you,
yes,
or found you, yes.
Yeah.
I know that they said in The Sun that, of course, no one was looking for a Dr. Hayden clone. But I wonder what it felt like to you filling such large shoes.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's so funny because I've had people say, oh, it must be so hard to follow such a legend. And I'm like, oh, I just really didn't think about it until just now. But I myself have had a lot of respect and admiration for Dr. Carla Hayden. And she's had an incredible career. And I've watched the Pratt for most of my professional career. The director I worked for in Houston, she would send the compass to me, you know, every month to look at. And so I was always like, oh, what is the Pratt doing? I should check out the Pratt. So when the position opened, first of all, everyone was thrilled that Dr. Hayden was chosen as Librarian of Congress, because it's just huge for basically every reason there could be. She was the first, you know, African-American, the first female, first actual degree-holding librarian. So it's cool in a number of ways, right? And so I was excited along with everyone else for that. And then, of course, I instantly started to think, oh, well, they're going to need a new CEO. And when I saw the posting, I almost didn't apply, but my husband said, well, I don't want to listen to you talk about how you could have been the CEO of the Pratt for the next 10 years. So just do us a favor and apply. And if you don't get it, you know, and you could walk away. It's like, oh, yeah, you're right. I will. So I really felt like it was kind of a whirlwind. Like I applied. I really didn't expect it to go anywhere. And then before I knew it, I was sitting in an interview with the Baltimore Sun because I'd just been hired. And it was like, I don't know how this happened. This is crazy. And so following Dr. Carla Hayden is really great in a lot of ways, because she's built the library system into the legend that it is in the city and did a great job. And I would much rather prefer that than walking into a situation where, you know, the library is not, hasn't been in great hands and hasn't been well thought of in the community. So it's really only positive. And of course, they are huge shoes to fill. But you know, we're different people, we're different leadership styles, we're different focuses, the times, you know, that we're working in will be different. So I'm confident that it'll all be fine.
We kind of talked about it with the children's books, I guess. But yeah, I wonder, like you said, Dr. Hayden was a first in more ways than one, becoming right. The Librarian of Congress. I wonder, you know, not to pigeonhole you with this question, but as a female librarian, what impact do you think visibility has, especially on younger children? And to you, did Dr. Hayden becoming the Librarian of Congress, was it symbolic in any kind of larger way?
Of course, I think it was symbolic in a larger way for everyone. You know, it's incredible to have the first African-American female Librarian of Congress, and to have her have come from the Pratt. I think for young children, it's really important to see themselves in figures of leadership and of power. So I think that for the Pratt, that was really amazing to have her as the director. Anna Curry before her was the first African-American director. So, you know, obviously I'm a break from that. I'm Caucasian female. But I think for me, it's about the work that we're doing and the work that I'm doing. So I'm hoping to keep uplifting people. I mean, it will be obviously in a different way, but there's lots of ways that I think we can uplift the city. And I think for me, I wasn't, you know, I'm first generation. My first, you know, my parents didn't go to college. So offering support and education to the city and the community is something that is really important to me. And so I think my work is to just keep doing the work of uplifting everyone in the city of Baltimore. And I hope that I can do that. And I feel confident that I can. But certainly Dr. Hayden's selection for the Library of Congress was a symbolic one and I think a really positive one.
Do you have time to read anymore?
No. No, I do. I also, you know, I also have to, I'm a mother and I have two young children, so I'm spending time reading. We're reading Wrinkle in Time right now because we just went and saw the movie, so we're reading that together at night. So to some degree, I read children's books, but I still read on my own. I have a stack of books on my bedside table as we speak, and actually one of them is the historical architecture of Baltimore, and another is, I think, it's called Not in My Town.
Not in My Neighborhood.
Not in My Neighborhood,
that's a,
yes.
That's a great book. That's a Baltimore classic.
Yes. So I feel like that's something that was a must read for moving to Baltimore. And I'm also, I just finished Little Fires Everywhere.
I have bought that, but I haven't read it yet.
It's fabulous. Okay. I really loved it. Yeah, it's great. It was one of the books that I read in like two nights. I just finished An American Marriage by Tayari Jones because we had her recently, and that was also a great book. I highly recommend it. It was also a pretty fast read, but very thought-provoking.
You're still reading. You say no.
I know. So I think for me, I feel like I've taken a little bit of a downturn. But I'm reading more fiction maybe than anything else because I kind of want an escape. So if I wake up at 2 in the morning and I have, you know, work on my mind, if I slip into Little Fires Everywhere and it's, you know, this suburban Cleveland situation, I'm not thinking about the elevators and the Central Library. And so it's great to be able to have fiction to do that, to take you away from your daily life. And then I'm reading a book right now called Counterculture that's about organizational culture. So I read a little bit for work, but I'm doing a lot of fiction reading more than anything lately.
So beyond the renovations, the branches, all of the tangible things that you're working on, what is your ambition for the Pratt Library in a larger sense?
So I want us to really continue to be that beacon for the city of Baltimore. And I want to make sure that it doesn't end with this generation, but that it keeps going. A huge point for me is to remove barriers to access. So I think we still have a lot of ways we can make our buildings and our collections and our services more accessible to the city of Baltimore, regardless of, you know, race, income, gender, religion, just as Enoch Pratt's vision had stated, because the Pratt's really unique in that it was founded on the idea of it shall be for all, as opposed to, you know, a library that was just meant for a white community. So I think I hope that Baltimore can continue to embrace the Pratt in the same way, and that we can keep being that place of possibility, that place of yes, that place of course you can, and how can we help you? And we're going to have to be really flexible and nimble to keep that moving forward. And I think we can do it.
Heidi, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Heidi Daniel. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. Female Trouble is available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and everywhere else. We're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble. You can find more at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back soon.